host another species, requiring rites and prayers that belonged uniquely to them. She was surrounded on every side by such signs, epitaphs in English, French, Polish, and Russian, images of veiled women and shattered urns, saints whose martyrdom she could only guess at, stone dogs sleeping upon their masters' tombs, all the symbolism that accompanied this other people. And the more she explored, the more she found herself asking the question she'd posed the day before. Why was the cemetery so big? And why, as became apparent the more tombs she studied, were there so many nationalities laid here? She thought of her dream, of the wind that had come from all quarters of the earth. It was as if there'd been something prophetic in it. The thought didn't worry her. If that was the way the world worked, by omens and prophecies, then it was at least a system, and she had lived too long without one. Love had failed her. Perhaps this would not. It took her an hour, wandering down the hushed avenues, to reach the back wall of the cemetery, against which she found a row of animal graves, cats interred beside birds, dogs beside cats, at peace with each other as common clay. It was an odd sight. Though she knew of other animal cemeteries, she'd never heard of pets being laid in the same consecrated ground as their owners. But then should she be surprised at anything here? The place was a law unto itself, built far from any who would care or condemn. Turning from the back wall, she could see no sign of the front gate, nor could she remember which of the avenues led back there. It didn't matter. She felt secure in the emptiness of the place, and there was a good deal she wanted to see. Sepulchres whose architecture, towering over its fellows, invited admiration. Choosing a route that would take in half a dozen of the most promising, she began an idling return journey. The sun was warmer by the minute now as it climbed toward noon. Though her pace was slow, she broke out into a sweat, and her throat became steadily drier. It would be no short drive to find somewhere to quench her thirst, but parched throat or no, she didn't hurry. She knew she'd never come here again. She intended to leave with her memories well stocked. Along the way were several tombs that had been virtually overtaken by saplings planted in front of them. Evergreens, mostly, reminders of the life eternal, the trees flourished in the seclusion of the walls, fed well on rich soil. In some cases, their spreading roots had cracked the very memorials they'd been planted to offer shade and protection. These scenes of verdancy and ruin she found particularly poignant. She was lingering at one, when the perfect silence was broken. Hidden in the foliage, somebody or something was panting. She automatically stepped out of the tree's shadow and into the hot sun. Shock made her heart beat furiously, its thump deafening her to the sound that had excited it. She had to wait for a few moments and listen hard to be sure she'd not imagined the sound. There was no error. Something was in hiding beneath the branches of the tree, which were so weighed by their burden of leaves they almost touched the ground. The sound, now that she listened more carefully, was not human, nor was it healthy. Its roughness and raggedness suggested a dying animal. She stood in the heat of the sun for a minute or more, just staring into the mass of foliage and shadow, trying to catch some sight of the creature. Occasionally there was a movement, a body vainly trying to right itself, a desperate pawing at the ground as the creature tried to rise. Its helplessness touched her. If she failed to do what she could for it, the animal would certainly perish, knowing, this was the thought that moved her to action, that someone had heard its agony and passed it by. She stepped back into the shadow. For a moment, the panting stopped completely. Perhaps the creature was fearful of her and, reading her approach as aggression, preparing some final act of defense. Readying herself to retreat before claws and teeth, she parted the outer twigs and peered through the mesh of branches. Her first impression was not one of sight or sound, but of smell. A bittersweet scent that was not unpleasant, its source the pale-flanked creature she now made out in the murk, gazing at her wide-eyed. It was a young animal, she guessed, but of no species she could name. A wildcat of some kind, perhaps, but the skin resembled deer hide rather than fur. It watched her warily, its neck barely able to support the weight of its delicately marked head. Even as she returned its gaze, it seemed to give up on life. Its eyes closed, and its head sank to the ground. The resilience of the branches defied any further approach. Rather than attempting to bend them aside, she began to break them in order to get to the failing creature. They were living wood and fought back. Halfway through the thicket, a particularly truculent branch snapped back in her face with such stinging force it brought a shout of pain from her. She put her hand to her cheek. The skin to the right of her mouth was broken. Dabbing the blood away, she attacked the branch with fresh vigor, at last coming within reach of the animal. It was almost beyond responding to her touch, its eyes momentarily fluttering open as she stroked its flank, then closing again. There was no sign that she could see of a wound, but the body beneath her hand was feverish and full of tremors. As she struggled to pick the animal up, it began to urinate, wetting her hands and blouse. But she drew it to her nevertheless, a dead weight in her arms. Beyond the spasms that ran through its nervous system, there was no power left in its muscles. Its limbs hung limply, its head the same. Only the smell she'd first encountered had any strength, intensifying as the creature's final moments approached. Something like a sob reached her ears. She froze. Again, the sound. Off to her left some way, and barely suppressed. She stepped back out of the shadow of the tree, bringing the dying animal with her. As the sunlight fell on the creature, it responded with a violence that utterly belied its apparent frailty, its limbs jerking madly. She stepped back into the shade, instinct telling her the brightness was responsible. Only then did she look again in the direction from which the sob had come. The door of one of the mausoleums farther down the avenue, a massive structure of cracked marble, stood ajar, and in the column of darkness beyond she could vaguely make out a human figure. Vaguely, because it was dressed in black and seemed to be veiled. She could make no sense of this scenario. The dying animal tormented by light, the sobbing woman, surely a woman, in the doorway, dressed for mourning. "Who are you?" she called out. The mourner seemed to shrink back into the shadows as she was addressed, then regretted the move and approached the open door again. But so very tentatively the connection between animal and woman became clear. "She's afraid of the sun, too," Laurie thought. They belong together, animal and mourner, the woman sobbing for the creature Laurie had in her arms. She looked at the pavement that lay between where she stood and the mausoleum. Could she get to the door of the tomb without having to step back into the sun and so hasten the creature's demise? Perhaps with care. Planning her route before she moved, she started to cross toward the mausoleum, using the shadows like stepping stones. She didn't look up at the door. Her attention was wholly focused on keeping the animal from the light. But she could feel the mourner's presence willing her on. Once the woman gave voice, not with a word, but with a soft sound, a cradle-side sound, addressed not to Laurie, but to the dying animal. With the mausoleum door 3 or 4 yards from her, Laurie dared to look up. The woman in the door could be patient no longer. She reached out from her refuge, her arms bared as the garment she wore rode back, her flesh exposed to the sunlight. The skin was white, as ice, as paper, but only for an instant. As the fingers stretched to relieve Laurie of her burden, they darkened and swelled as though instantly bruised. The mourner made a cry of pain and almost fell back into the tomb as she withdrew her arms, but not before the skin broke and trails of dust, yellowish like pollen, burst from her fingers and fell through the sunlight onto the patio. Seconds later, Laurie was at the door, then through it into the safety of the darkness beyond. The room was no more than an antechamber. 2 doors led from it, one into a chapel of some sort, the other below ground. The woman in mourning was standing at this second door, which was open, as far from the wounding light as she could get. In her haste, her veil had fallen. The face beneath was fine-boned and thin, almost to the point of being wasted, lending additional force to her eyes, which caught, even in the darkest corner of the room, some trace of light from the open door, so that they seemed almost to glow. Lori felt no trace of fear. It was the other woman who trembled as she nursed her sun-struck hands, her gaze moving from Lori's bewildered face to the animal.
"I'm afraid it's dead," Lori said, not knowing what disease afflicted this woman, but recognizing her grief from all too recent memory.
"No," the woman said with quiet conviction. "She can't die." Her words were statement, not entreaty, but the stillness in Lori's arms contradicted such certainty. If the creature wasn't yet dead, it was surely beyond recall.
"Will you bring her to me?" the woman asked.
Lori hesitated, though the weight of the body was making her arms ache, and she wanted the duty done. She didn't want to cross the chamber.
"Please," the woman said, reaching out with wounded hands.
Relenting, Lori left the comfort of the door and the sunlit patio beyond. She'd taken only two or three steps, however, when she heard the sound of whispering. There could only be one source, the stairs. There were people in the crypt. She stopped walking, childhood superstitions rising up in her. Fear of tombs, fear of stairs descending, fear of the underworld.
"It's nobody," the woman said, her face pained. "Please, bring me Babette."
As if to further reassure Lori, she took a step away from the stairs, murmuring to the animal she'd called Babette. Either the words or the woman's proximity, or perhaps the cool darkness of the chamber, won a response from the creature. A tremor ran down its spine like an electrical charge, so strong Lori almost lost hold of it. The woman's murmurs grew louder, as if she were chiding the dying thing, her anxiety to claim it suddenly urgent. But there was an impasse. Lori was no more willing to approach the entrance to the crypt than the woman was to come another step toward the outer door, and in the seconds of stasis, the animal found new life. One of its claws seized Lori's breast as it began to writhe in her embrace. The chiding became a shout.
"Babette!"
But if the creature heard, it didn't care to listen. Its motion became more violent, a mingling of fit and sensuality. One moment it shuddered as though tortured, the next it moved like a snake sloughing off its skin.
"Don't look! Don't look!"
she heard the woman say. But Lori wasn't about to take her eyes off this horrendous dance, nor could she give the creature over to the woman's charge. While the claw gripped her so tightly, any attempt to separate them would draw blood. But that "don't look" had purpose. Now it was Lori's turn to raise her voice in panic, as she realized that what was taking place in her arms defied all reason.
"Jesus God!"
The animal was changing before her eyes. In the luxury of slough and spasm, it was losing its bestiality, not by reordering its anatomy, but by liquefying its whole self, through to the bone, until what had been solid was a tumble of matter. Here was the origin of the bittersweet scent she'd met beneath the tree, the stuff of the beast's dissolution. In the moment it lost its coherence, the matter was ready to be out of her grasp, but somehow the essence of the thing, its will, perhaps its soul, drew it back for the business of remaking. The last part of the beast to melt was the claw, its disintegration sending a throb of pleasure through Lori's body. It did not distract her from the fact that she was released. Horrified, she couldn't get what she held from her embrace fast enough, tipping it into the mourner's outstretched arms like so much excrement.
"Jesus," she said, backing away. "Jesus, Jesus."
There was no horror on the woman's face, however, only joy. Tears of welcome rolled down her pale cheeks and fell into the melting pot she held. Lori looked away toward the sunlight. After the gloom of the interior, it was blinding. She was momentarily disoriented and closed her eyes to allow herself a reprieve from both tomb and light. It was sobbing that made her open her eyes. Not the woman this time, but a child,
a girl of 4 or 5, lying naked where the muck of transformation had been.
"Babette," the woman said.
"Impossible," reason replied. This thin white child could not be the animal she'd rescued from beneath a tree. It was sleight of hand or some idiot delusion she'd foisted upon herself. Impossible, all impossible.
"She likes to play outside,"
the woman was saying, looking up from the child at Lori.
"And I tell her, never, never in the sun, never play in the sun. But she's a child. She doesn't understand."
"Impossible," reason repeated. But somewhere in her gut, Lori had already given up trying to deny. The animal had been real. The transformation had been real. Now here was a living child, weeping in her mother's arms. She too was real. Every moment she wasted saying no to what she knew was a moment lost to comprehension. That her worldview couldn't contain such a mystery without shattering was its liability and a problem for another day. For now she simply wanted to be away, into the sunlight where she knew these shapeshifters feared to follow. Not daring to take her eyes off them until she was in the sun, she reached out to the wall to guide her tentative backward steps. But Babette's mother wanted to hold her a while longer.
"I owe you something," she said.
"No," Lori replied. "I don't want anything from you." She felt the urge to express her revulsion. But the scene of reunion before her, the child reaching up to touch her mother's chin, her sobs passing, was so tender. Disgust became bewilderment, fear, confusion.
"Let me help you," the woman said. "I know why you came here."
"I doubt it," Lori said.
"Don't waste your time here," the woman replied. "There's nothing for you here. Midian's a home for the night breed. Only the night breed."
Her voice had dropped in volume. It was barely above a whisper.
"The nightbreed,"
Lori said, more loudly. The woman looked pained.
"Shh," she said. "I shouldn't be telling you this, but I owe you this much at least."
Lori had stopped her retreat to the door. Her instinct was telling her to wait.
"Do you know a man called Boone?" she said.
The woman opened her mouth to reply, her face a mass of contrary feelings. She wanted to answer, that much was clear, but fear prevented her from speaking. It didn't matter. Her hesitation was answer enough. She did know Boone, or had.
"Rachel."
A voice rose from the door that led down into the earth, a man's voice.
"Come away," it demanded. "You've nothing to tell."
The woman looked toward the stairs.
"Mr. Lylesburg," she said, her tone formal, "she saved Babette."
"We know," came the reply from the darkness. "We saw. Still, you must come away."
"We," Lori thought. How many others were there below ground? How many more of the night breed? Taking confidence from the proximity of the open door, she challenged the voice that was attempting to silence her informant.
"I saved the child," she said. "I think I deserve something for that."
There was a silence from the darkness, then a point of heated ash brightened in its midst, and Lori realized that Mr. Lylesburg was standing almost at the top of the stairs, where the light from outside should have illuminated him, albeit poorly, but that somehow the shadows were clotted about him, leaving him invisible but for his cigarette.
"The child has no life to save," he said to Lori. "But what she has is yours, if you want it." He paused. "Do you want it? If you do, take her. She belongs to you."
The notion of this exchange horrified her.
"What do you take me for?" she said.
"I don't know," Lylesburg replied. "You were the one who demanded recompense."
"I just want some questions answered," Lori protested. "I don't want the child. I'm not a savage."
"No," the voice said softly. "No, you're not. So go. You've no business here."
He drew on the cigarette, and by its tiny light, Lori glimpsed the speaker's features. She sensed that he willingly revealed himself in this moment, dropping the veil of shadow for a handful of instants to meet her gaze face to face. He, like Rachel, was wasted, his gauntness more acute because his bones were large and made for solid cladding. Now, with his eyes sunk into their sockets and the muscles of his face all too plain beneath papery skin, it was the sweep of his brow that dominated, furrowed and sickly.
"This was never intended," he said. "You weren't meant to see."
"I know that," Lori replied.
"Then you also know that to speak of this will bring dire consequences."
"Don't threaten me."
"Not for you," Lylesburg said. "For us."
She felt a twinge of shame at her misunderstanding. She wasn't the vulnerable one, she who could walk in the sunlight. "I won't say anything," she told him.
"I thank you," he said.
He drew on his cigarette again, and the dark smoke took his face from view.
"What's below," he said from behind the veil, "remains below."
Rachel sighed softly at this, gazing down at the child as she rocked it gently.
"Come away," Lylesburg told her, and the shadows that concealed him moved off down the stairs.
"I have to go," Rachel said, and turned to follow. "Forget you were ever here. There's nothing you can do. You heard Mr. Lylesburg. What's below remains below."
"Yes, I heard."
"Midians for the breed. There's no one here who needs you."
"Just tell me," Lori requested. "Is Boone here?"
Rachel was already at the top of the stairs and now began to descend.
"He is, isn't he?"
Lori said, forsaking the safety of the open door and crossing the chamber toward Rachel.
"You people stole the body."
It made some terrible, macabre sense. Those tomb dwellers, this night breed, keeping Boone from being laid to rest.
"You did. You stole him."
Rachel paused and looked back up at Lori, her face barely visible in the blackness of the stairs.
"We stole nothing," she said, her reply without rancor.
"So where is he?" Lori demanded.
Rachel turned away, and the shadows took her completely from view.
"Tell me, please God," Lori yelled down after her.
Suddenly she was crying in a turmoil of rage and fear and frustration.
"Tell me, please."
Desperation carried her down the stairs after Rachel, her shouts becoming appeals.
"Wait, talk to me."
She took three steps, then a fourth. On the fifth, she stopped. Or rather, her body stopped, the muscles of her legs becoming rigid without her instruction, refusing to carry her another step into the darkness of the crypt. Her skin was suddenly crawling with goose flesh, her pulse thumping in her ears. No force of will could overrule the animal imperative forbidding her to descend. All she could do was stand rooted to the spot and stare into the depths. Even her tears had suddenly dried and the saliva gone from her mouth, so she could no more speak than walk. Not that she wanted to call down into the darkness now, for fear the forces there would answer her summons. Though she could see nothing of them, her gut knew they were more terrible by far than Rachel and her beast child. Shape-shifting was almost a natural act beside the skills these others had to hand. She felt their perversity as a quality of the air. She breathed it in and out. It scoured her lungs and hurried her heart. If they had Boone's corpse as a plaything, it was beyond reclamation. She would have to take comfort from the hope that his spirit was somewhere brighter. Defeated, she took a step backward. The shadows seemed unwilling to relinquish her, however. She felt them weave themselves into her blouse and hook themselves on her eyelashes, a thousand tiny holds upon her, slowing her retreat.
"I won't tell anyone," she murmured. "Please let me go."
But the shadows held on, their power a promise of retribution if she defied them.
"I promise," she said. "What more can I do?"
And suddenly they capitulated. She hadn't realized how strong their claim was until it was withdrawn. She stumbled backward, falling up the stairs into the light of the antechamber. Turning her back on the crypt, she fled for the door and out into the sun. It was too bright. She covered her eyes, holding herself upright by gripping the stone portico so that she could accustom herself to its violence. It took several minutes, standing against the mausoleum, shaking and rigid by turn. Only when she felt able to see through half-closed eyes did she attempt to walk. Her route back to the main gate a farrago of cul-de-sacs and missed turnings. By the time she reached it, however, she'd more or less accustomed herself to the brutality of light and sky. Her body was still not back at her mind's disposal, however. Her legs refused to carry her more than a few paces up the hill to Midian without threatening to drop her to the ground. Her system, overdosed on adrenaline, was cavorting. But at least she was alive. For a short while there on the stairs it had been touch and go. The shadows that had held her by lash and thread could have taken her, she had no doubt of that, claimed her for the underworld, and snuffed her out. Why had they released her? Perhaps because she'd saved the child. Perhaps because she'd sworn silence and they'd trusted her. Neither, however, seemed the motives of monsters, and she had to believe that what lived beneath Midian's cemetery deserved that name. Who other than monsters made their nests among the dead? They might call themselves the Nightbreed, but neither words nor gestures of good faith could disguise their true nature. She had escaped demons, things of rot and wickedness, and she would have offered up a prayer of thanks for her deliverance if the sky had not been so wide and bright, and so plainly devoid of deities to hear. Part 3. Dark Ages. Out on the town, with two skins, the leather and the flesh, three if you count the four, all out to be touched tonight, yes, sir, all ready to be rubbed and nuzzled and loved tonight, yes, sir. Charles Kidd, Hanging by a Thread. Chapter 11. The Stalking Ground. 1. Driving back to Sheer Neck, the radio turned up to a deafening level both to confirm her existence and keep it from straying. She became more certain by the mile that, promises notwithstanding, she'd not be able to conceal the experience from Cheryl. How could it not be obvious in her face, in her voice? Such fears proved groundless. Either she was better at concealment than she'd thought, or Cheryl was more insensitive. Either way, Cheryl asked only the most perfunctory questions about Lori's return visit to Midian before moving on to talk of Curtis. "I want you to meet him," she said, "just to be sure I'm not dreaming." "I'm going to go home, Cheryl," Lori said. "Not tonight, surely. It's too late." She was right. The day was too advanced for Lori to contemplate a homeward trip, nor could she fabricate a reason for denying Cheryl's request without offending. "You won't feel like a lemon, I promise," Cheryl said. "He said he wanted to meet you. I've told him all about you. Well, not all, but enough, you know, about how we met." She made a forlorn face. "Say you'll come," she said. "I'll come." "Fabulous. I'll call him right now." While Cheryl went about making her call, Lori took a shower. There was news of the night's arrangements within 2 minutes. "He'll meet us at this restaurant he knows around 8, Cheryl hollered. "He'll even find a friend for you." "No, Cheryl. I think he was just kidding," came the reply. Cheryl appeared at the bathroom door. "He's got a funny sense of humor," she said. "You know, when you're not sure if someone's making a joke or not, he's like that." Great, Lori thought. A failed comedian. But there was something undeniably comforting about coming back to Cheryl and this girlish passion. Her endless talk of Curtis, none of which gave Lori more than a street artist's portrait of the man, all surface and no insight, was the perfect distraction from thoughts of Midian and its revelations. The early evening was so filled with good humor and the ritual of preparing for a night on the town that on occasion Lori found herself wondering if all that had happened in the necropolis had not been a hallucination. But she had evidence that confirmed the memory, the cut beside her mouth from that wayward branch. It was little enough sign, but the sharp hurt of it kept her from doubting her sanity. She had been to Midian. She had held the shapeshifter in her arms and stood on the crypt stairs, gazing into a miasma so profound it could have rotted the faith of a saint. Though the unholy world beneath the cemetery was as far from Cheryl and her whirlwind romance as night from day, it was no less real for that. In time she would have to address that reality, find a place for it, though it defied all logic. For now, she would keep it in mind, with the cut as its guardian, and enjoy the pleasures of the evening ahead. 2. "It's a joke," said Cheryl as they stood outside the Hudson Bay sunset. "Didn't I tell you he had this weird sense of humor?" The restaurant he'd named had been completely gutted by fire several weeks ago, to judge by the state of the timbers. "Are you sure you got the right address?" Laurie asked. Cheryl laughed. "I tell you, it's one of his jokes," she said. "So we've laughed," said Laurie. "When do we get to eat?" "He's probably watching us," Cheryl said, her good humor slightly forced. Laurie looked around for some sign of the voyeur. Though there was nothing to fear in the streets of a town like this, even on a Saturday night, the neighborhood was far from welcoming. Every other shop along the block was closed up, and the sidewalks completely deserted in both directions. It was no place they wanted to linger. "I don't see him," Laurie said. "Neither do I." "So what do we do now?" Laurie asked, doing her best to keep any trace of irritation from her voice. If this was Curtis the Beau's idea of a good time, Cheryl's taste had to be in doubt. But then who was she to judge, who'd loved and lost a psycho? "He's got to be here somewhere," Cheryl said hopefully. "Curtis?" she called out, pushing open the heat-blistered door. "Why don't we wait for him out here, Cheryl?" "He's probably inside. The place could be dangerous." Her appeal was ignored. "Cheryl." "I hear you. I'm okay." She was already immersed in the darkness of the interior. The smell of burned wood and fabric stung Laurie's nostrils. "Curtis," she heard Cheryl call. A car went past, its engine badly tuned. The passenger, a youth, prematurely balding, leaned out of the window. "Need any help?" "No, thanks," Laurie yelled back, not certain if the question was small-town courtesy or a come-on. Probably the latter, she decided, as the car picked up speed and disappeared. People were the same all over. Her mood, which had improved by leaps and bounds since she'd been back in Cheryl's company, was rapidly souring. She didn't like being on this empty street, with what little was left of the day sliding toward extinction. The night, which had always been a place of promise, belonged too much to the breed who had taken its name for themselves. And why not? All darkness was one darkness in the end, of heart or heavens one darkness. Even now, in Midian, they'd be dragging back the doors of the mausoleums, knowing that the starlight would not wither them. She shuddered at the thought. Off down one of the streets, she heard the car engine rev up and roar, then a squeal of brakes. Were the Good Samaritans coming around for a second look? "Cheryl," she called out, "where are you?" The joke, if joke it had been and not Cheryl's error, had long since lost what questionable humor it had. She wanted to get back into the car and drive, back to the hotel if necessary. "Cheryl, are you there?" There was laughter from the interior of the building, Cheryl's gurgling laughter. Suspecting now her compliance in this fiasco, Laurie stepped through the door in search of the tricksters. The laughter came again, then broke off as Cheryl said, "Curtis," in a tone of mock indignation that decayed into further inane laughter. So the great lover was here. Laurie half contemplated returning to the street, getting back into the car and leaving them to their damn fool games. But the thought of the evening alone in the hotel room, listening to more partying, spurred her on through an assault course of burned furniture. Had it not been for the brightness of floor tiles throwing the street light up toward the cage of ceiling beams, she might not have risked advancing far. But ahead she could dimly see the archway through which Cheryl's laughter had floated. She made her way toward it. All sound had ceased. They were watching her every tentative step. She felt their scrutiny.
"Come on, guys," she said. "Joke's over. I'm hungry."
There was no reply. Behind her on the street, she heard the Samaritans yelling. Retreat was not advisable. She advanced, stepping through the archway. Her first thought was, he only told half a lie. This was a restaurant. The exploration had taken her into a kitchen, where probably the fire had started. It, too, was tiled in white, surfaces smoke-stained, but still bright enough to lend the whole interior, which was large, an odd luminescence. She stood in the doorway and scanned the room. The largest of the stoves was placed in the center, racks of shining utensils still hanging above it, truncating her view. The jokers had to be in hiding on the other side of the range. It was the only refuge the room offered. Despite her anxieties, she felt an echo here of remembered games of hide-and-seek. The first game, because the simplest. How she'd love to be terrorized by her father, chased and caught. If only he were here in hiding now, she found herself thinking, waiting to embrace her. But cancer had long since caught him by the throat.
"Cheryl," she said, "I give up. Where are you?"
Even as she spoke, her advance brought her within sight of one of the players, and the game ended. Cheryl was not in hiding, unless death was hiding. She was crouched against the stove, the darkness around her too wet for shadow, her head thrown back, her face slashed open.
"Jesus God!"
Behind Lori, a sound. Somebody coming to find her. Too late to hide. She'd be caught, and not by loving arms, not by her father playing the monster. This was the monster itself. She turned to see its face before it took her. But running at her was a sewing box doll. Zipper for mouth, buttons for eyes, all sewn on white linen and tied around the monster's face so tightly his saliva darkened a patch around his mouth. She was denied the face, but not the teeth. He held them above his head, gleaming knives, their blades fine as grass stalks, sweeping down to stab out her eyes. She threw herself out of their reach, but he was after her in an instant, the mouth behind the zipper calling her name.
"Better get it over with, Lori."
The blades were coming at her again, but she was quicker. The mask didn't seem too hurried. He closed on her with a steady step, his confidence obscene.
"Cheryl had the right idea," he said. "She just stood there and let it happen."
"Fuck you!"
"Later, maybe."
He ran one of the blades along the row of hanging pots, striking squeals and sparks.
"Later, when you're a little colder," he laughed, the zipper gaping. "There's something to look forward to."
She let him talk while trying to get some sense of what escape routes lay open to her. The fire door was blocked by burning timbers. Her only exit was the arch through which she'd entered, and the mask stood between her and it, sharpening his teeth on each other. He started toward her again. No jibes from him now. The time for talk was over. As he closed on her, she thought of Midian. Surely she'd not survived its terrors to be hacked to death by some lone psycho. Fuck him. As the knife slid toward her, she snatched a pot from the rack above the range and brought it up to meet his face. It connected squarely. Her strength shocked her. The mask reeled, dropping one of his blades. There was no sound from behind the linen, however. He merely transferred the remaining blade from right hand to left, shook his head as if to stop its singing, and came at her again, at a rush. She barely had time to raise the pan in defense. The blade slid down it and met her hand. For a moment, there was no pain, nor even blood. Then both came in profusion, the pan falling from her hand at her feet. Now he made a sound, a cooing sound, the tilt of his head suggesting that it was the blood he was staring at as it ran from the wound he'd fathered. She looked toward the door, calculating the time it would take to get there against his speed of pursuit. But before she could act, the mask began his last advance. The knife was not raised. Nor was his voice when he spoke.
"Lori," he said, "we must talk, you and me. Keep the fuck away."
To her amazement, he obeyed the instructions. She seized what little time this offered to claim his other blade from the floor. She was less competent with her unwounded hand, but he was a large target. She could do him damage, preferably through the heart. "That's what I killed Cheryl with," he said. "I'd put it down if I were you." The steel was sticky in her palm. "Yes, that slit little Cheryl ear to ear," he went on. "And now you've got your prints all over it. You should have worn gloves, like me." The thought of what the blade had done appalled her, but she wasn't about to drop it and stand unarmed. "Of course you could always blame Boone," the mask was saying. "Tell the police he did it." "How'd you know about Boone?" she said. "Hadn't Cheryl sworn she'd told her paramour nothing?" "You know where he is," the mask stated. "He's dead," she replied. The sewing box face denied it with a shake. "No, I'm afraid not. He got up and walked, God knows how, but he got up and walked. Can you imagine that? The man was pumped full of bullets. You saw the blood he shed." "He was watching us all the time," she thought. "He followed us to Midian that first day. But why?" That was what she couldn't make sense of. Why? All that blood, all those bullets. And still he wouldn't lie down dead. "Somebody stole the body," she said. "No," came the reply. "That's not the way it was." "Who the hell are you?" "Good question." "No reason why you shouldn't have an answer." His hand went up to his face and he pulled off the mask. Beneath was Decker, sweaty and smiling. "I wish I'd brought my camera," he said. "The look on your face." The shock made her gape like a fish. Decker was Curtis, Cheryl's Mr. Wright. "Why?" she demanded. "Why what?" "Why did you kill Cheryl?" "For the same reason I killed all the others," he said lightly, as though the question hadn't much vexed him. Then, deadly serious, "For the fun of it, of course. For the pleasure. We used to talk a lot about why, Boone and me. Digging deep, you know, trying to understand. But when it really comes down to it, I do it because I like it." "Boone was innocent."
"Is innocent, wherever he's hiding. Which is a problem, because he knows the real facts, and one of these days he might find someone to convince of the truth."
"So you want to stop him?"
"Wouldn't you? All the trouble I went to so he could die a guilty man. I even put a bullet in him myself, and he still gets up and walks away."
"They told me he was dead. They were certain. The mortuary was unlocked from the inside. Did they tell you that? His fingerprints were on the handle, his footprints on the door. Did they tell you that?"
"No, of course not. But I'm telling you."
"I know. Boone is alive, and your death is going to bring him out of hiding. I'll bet on it. He'll have to show himself."
Slowly, as he spoke, he was raising the knife. "If it's only to mourn."
Suddenly he was at her. She put the blade that had killed Cheryl between her and his approach. It slowed him, but he didn't stop coming.
"Could you really do it?" he said to her. "I don't think so. And I speak from experience. People are squeamish even when their lives are at stake. And that knife, of course, it's already been blunted on poor Cheryl. You'll have to really dig to make some impression on me."
He spoke almost playfully, still advancing.
"I'd like to see you try, though," he said. "I really would like to see you try."
Out of the corner of her eye, she was aware that she'd come abreast of piled plates mere inches from her elbow. Might they offer her time enough to get to the door? She wondered. In knife-to-knife combat with this maniac, she'd lose, no doubt of it, but she might yet outwit him.
"Come on, try me. Kill me if you can. For Boone! For poor, mad Boone!"
As the words became laughter, she threw her wounded hand out toward the plates, hooked them round, and flung them onto the floor in front of Decker. A second pile followed, and a third, china shards flying up in all directions. He took a step back, his hands going up to his face to protect himself, and she took the chance while she had it, bolting for the archway. She got through it and into the restaurant itself before she heard his pursuit. By that time, she had sufficient lead to reach the outer door and fling herself through it onto the street. Once on the sidewalk, she immediately turned and faced the door through which he would come, but he had no intention of following her into the light.
"Clever bitch," he said from the darkness. "I'll get you. When I've got Boone, I'll come back for you. You just count the breaths till then."
eyes still fixed on the door, she backed off down the sidewalk toward the car. Only now did she realize that she still carried the murder weapon, her grip so strong she felt almost glued to it. She had no choice but to take it with her and give it and her evidence to the police. Back to the car, she opened the door and got in, only looking away from the burned-out building when the locks were on. Then she threw the knife onto the floor in front of the passenger seat, started the engine, and drove. 3. The choice before her came down to this: the police or Midian, a night of interrogation or a return to the necropolis. If she chose the former, she would not be able to warn Boone of Decker's pursuit. But then suppose Decker had been lying and Boone had not survived the bullets. She'd not only be fleeing from the scene of a murder, but putting herself within reach of the night breeders, and uselessly. Yesterday she would have chosen to go to the law. She would have trusted that its procedures would make all these mysteries come clear, that they would believe her story and bring Decker to justice. But yesterday she'd thought beasts were beasts, and children children. She'd thought that only the dead lived in the earth, and that they were peaceful there. She'd thought doctors healed, and that when the madman's mask was raised, she would say, "But of course, that's a madman's face." All wrong. All so wrong. Yesterday's assumptions were gone to the wind. Anything might be true. Boone might be alive. She drove to Midian. Chapter 12. Above and Below. 1. Visions came to meet her down the highway, brought on by the after effects of shock and the loss of blood from her bound but wounded hand. They began like snow blown toward the windshield, flakes of brightness that defied the glass and flew past her, whining as they went. As her dreamy state worsened, she seemed to see faces flying at her, and commas of life like fetuses, which whispered as they tumbled past. The spectacle did not distress her, quite the reverse. It seemed to confirm a scenario her hallucinating mind had created, that she, like Boone, was living a charmed life. Nothing could harm her, not tonight, though her cut hand was now so numb it could no longer grip the wheel, leaving her to navigate an unlit road one-handed and at speed. Fate had not let her survive Decker's attack, only to kill her on the highway. There was a reunion in the air. That was why the visions came, racing into the headlights and skipping over the car to burst above her in showers of white lights. They were welcoming her to Midian. 2. Once she looked in the mirror and thought she glimpsed a car behind her, its lights turned off. But when she looked again, it had gone. Perhaps it had never been there. Ahead lay the town, its houses blinded by her headlights. She drove down the main street all the way to the graveyard gates. The mingled intoxications of blood loss and exhaustion had dulled all fear of this place. If she could survive the malice of the living, she could surely survive the dead, or their companions. And Boone was here. That hope had hardened into certainty as she drove. Boone was here, and finally she'd be able to take him into her arms. She stumbled out of the car and almost fell flat on her face. Get up, she told herself. The lights were still coming at her, though she was no longer moving. But now all trace of detail in them had vanished. There was only the brightness, its ferocity threatening to wash the whole world away. Knowing total collapse was imminent, she crossed to the gates, calling Boone's name. She had an answer immediately, though not the one she sought. "He's here," somebody said. "Boone is here." Clinging to the gate, she turned her leaden head, and through the surf of light saw Decker, standing a few yards from her. Behind him, his lightless car. Even in her dizzied state, she understood how she'd been manipulated. Decker had allowed her to escape, knowing she'd seek out his enemy. Stupid, she told herself. Well, yes, but then what were you to do? No doubt you thought you might save him. She had neither the strength nor the wit to resist the man. Relinquishing the support of the gates, she staggered into the cemetery. "Boone!" she yelled. "Boone!" Decker didn't come after her quickly. He had no need. She was a wounded animal going in search of another wounded animal. Glancing behind her, she saw him checking his gun by the light of his headlights. Then he pushed the gate wider and came in pursuit. She could barely see the avenues in front of her for the bursts of light in her head. She was like a blind woman, sobbing as she stumbled, no longer even certain if Decker was behind her or in front. Any moment he would dispatch her. One bullet, and her charmed life would end. 3. In the ground below, the breed heard her arrival, their senses attuned to panic and despair. They knew the hunter's tread, too. They'd heard it behind them all too often. Now they waited, pitying the woman in her last moments, but too covetous of their refuge to put it at risk. There were few enough hiding places left where the monstrous might find peace. They'd not endanger their hermitage for a human life. Still, it pained them, hearing her pleas and her calls, and for one of their number, the sound was almost beyond endurance.
"Let me go to her." "You can't. You know you can't."
"I can kill him. Who's to know he was ever here?"
"He won't be alone. There'll be others waiting outside the walls. Remember how they came for you."
"I can't let her die."
"Boone! Please, God!"
It was worse than anything he'd suffered, hearing her calling him and knowing Midian's law wouldn't let him answer.
"Listen to her, for God's sake," he said. "Listen." "You made promises when we took you in," Lylesburg reminded him. "I know. I understand. I wonder if you do. They weren't demanded lightly, Boone. Break them and you belong nowhere. Not with us, not with them."
"You're asking me to listen to her die."
"So block your ears. It'll soon be over."
4. She could no longer find the breath to call his name. No matter. He wasn't here. Or if he was, he was dead in the earth and corrupted, beyond help in the giving or the taking. She was alone, and the man with the gun was closing on her. Decker took the mask from his pocket, the button mask he felt so safe behind. Oh, the number of times in those tiresome days with Boone, teaching him the dates and the places of the murders he was inheriting, when Decker's pride had almost brimmed over and he'd itched to reclaim the crimes. But he needed the scapegoat more than the quick thrill of confession to keep suspicion at bay. Boone's admitting to the crimes wouldn't have been an end to it all, of course. In time, the mask would start speaking to its owner again, demanding to be bloodied, and the killings would have to begin afresh. But not until Decker had found himself another name and another city to set up his store in. Boone had spoiled those well-laid plans, but he'd get no chance to tell what he knew. Old Buttonface would see to that. Decker pulled the mask on. It smelled of his excitement. As soon as he breathed in, he got a hard. Not the little sex hard, but the death hard, the murder hard. It sniffed the air for him, even through the thickness of his trousers and underwear. It smelled the victim that ran ahead of him. The mask didn't care that his prey was female. He got the murder hard for anyone. In his time, he'd had a heat for old men, pissing their pants as they went down in front of him. For girls, sometimes. Sometimes women. Even children. Old Buttonface looked with the same cross-threaded eyes on the whole of humanity. This one, this woman in the dark up ahead, meant no more to the mask than any of the others. Once they started to panic and bleed, they were all the same. He followed her with steady step. That was one of Buttonhead's trademarks, the executioner's tread. And she fled before him, her pleas deteriorating into snot and gasps. Though she hadn't got breath to call for her hero, no doubt she prayed he'd still come for her. Poor bitch. Didn't she know they never showed? He'd heard them all called upon in his time, begged for, bargained with, the holy fathers and mothers, the champions, the interceders. None of them ever showed. But her agony would be over soon. A shot through the back of the head to bring her down, and then he'd take the big knife, the heavy knife, to her face, the way he did with all of them. crisscross, crisscross, like the threads in his eye, till there was nothing left to look at but meat. Ah, she was falling, too tired to run any farther. He opened old Buttonhead's steel mouth and spoke to the fallen girl. "Be still," he said. "It's quicker that way." She tried to get up one final time, but her legs had given out completely, and the wash of whiteness was practically all-consuming. Giddily, she turned her head in the direction of Decker's voice, and in a trough between the white waves she saw that he'd put his mask back on. Its face was a death's head. He raised the gun. In the ground beneath her she felt tremors. Was it the sound of a shot, perhaps? She couldn't see the gun any longer, or even Decker. One final wave had washed him from sight. But her body felt the earth rock, and through the whine in her head she heard somebody calling the name of the man she'd hoped to find here. "Boone!" She didn't hear an answer. Perhaps there wasn't one, but the call came again, as if summoning him back into the earth. Before she could muster the last of her power to counter the call, her good arm gave out beneath her and she was face down on the ground. Buttonhead walked toward his quarry, disappointed that the woman would not be conscious to hear his final benediction. He liked to offer a few words of insight at the penultimate moment, words he never planned but that came like poetry from the zipper mouth. On occasion they'd laughed at his sermon, and that had made him cruel. But if they cried, and they often did, then he took it in good part and made certain the last moment, the very last, was swift and painless. He kicked the woman over onto her back to see if he could raise her from her sleep. And yes, her eyes flickered open slightly. "Good," he said, pointing the gun at her face. As he felt wisdom coming to his lips, he heard the growl. It drew his gaze off the woman for a moment. A soundless wind had risen from somewhere and was shaking the trees. There was complaint in the ground beneath his feet. The mask was untouched. Wandering in tomb yards didn't raise a hair on his neck. He was the new death, tomorrow's face today. What harm could dust do him? He laughed at the melodrama of it, threw back his head and laughed. At his feet the woman started moaning. Time to shut her up. He took aim at her open mouth. As he recognized the word she was shaping, the dark ahead of him divided, and that word stepped out of hiding.
"Boone," she'd said.
It was. He emerged from the shadow of the shaking trees, dressed just as the mask remembered, in dirty t-shirt and jeans. But there was a